Welcome to the last session of the day. I'm very pleased to be chairing this. My name is Adam Taylor, I'm a senior lecturer here at Cumbria. By Mike French from Glasgow. Mike is Professor of Economic and Social History at the University of Glasgow, and his research interests include US business history and economic history since 1850, becoming a sales representative, marketing consultant, and career leader in the UK in 1800. Mike collaborated with careers in food regulation policy. He's published on a number of areas, quite widely on white-collar occupations, including the Andrew Pop, practically uniform tribe, dress codes among commercial travellers, on the road travelling field and experiences of mobility in Britain before 1939, and also commercial career and culture travelling salesmen in Britain 1890 to 1930. And today he's going to speak on no longer frock coats and top hats, but still gentlemen. Appearance and identities on travelling salesmen in Britain. That's the other papers. It'll last about 45 minutes and we'll take questions at the end.
Okay, thanks very much, and thanks for the invitation. As you've said, I've worked on this a lot with Andrew Pop from the University of Liverpool, and what I was going to do today is talk a bit about commercial travellers in Britain mid-19th century through to about the 1930s, which is what we've looked at, and some of the continuities in who they are and what they do. And then a little bit at the end where I want to talk about commercial travellers in Britain moving into the 1940s and 1950s. Having with Andrew argued for a lot of continuity over about 120 years in how commercial travellers worked, how they saw themselves, and how everybody else saw them in popular culture, I've begun to wonder in the 1940s and 1950s if they suddenly hit a buffer where a lot of things about what they do starts to change. So I want to talk a bit about that at the end. The travelling salesmen have been written a lot about, particularly for the United States, and I suppose they've been written a lot about from the point of view of the rise of service occupations and what's sometimes called emotional labour, people whose work isn't particularly to do with anything they make, but their engagement with other people. And there's some very good writing by Spears and Friedman and Strasser and also by C. Wright Mills about selling and salesmen in the United States. And one of my initial interest in looking at Britain was to say, well, what happens in Britain? Mills put a lot of emphasis on salesmen as somehow embodying modern society, and this quote from 1951 has them working in a job where to some extent they have to shape their personality to engaging with customers whom they have to satisfy, and to some extent Mills thought also they were shaped by the people they worked for. Their employers wanted them to behave in certain ways. But as you can see from the quote, he also suggests at one point that everybody in part becomes a salesman, that there's some feature of modern society which turns everybody into trying to present themselves. And what Andrew and I were interested in looking at then was, well, in Britain, how did salesmen present themselves? How did they see themselves? Was there this codification, as Mills talks about, by employers of salesmen? How did they negotiate their identity? And I guess what I would argue in a nutshell is they're always middle class stroke lower middle class. It's not easy or predictable to sell things. If you're very good at it, you can make a lot of money and you're probably firmly middle or even upper middle class. If you're very bad at it, you don't hang around very long. You give up the career. And salesmen themselves then are always quite diverse. And in some ways they're always, I think, always negotiating a career which is fraught with the possibility of failure. There's a study in 1960 of commercial travellers which asks what they spend their time doing. And the answer comes back from a sample, 39% of their time they spend travelling, about 11% of their time they spend actually selling something. The stuff in the middle they spend negotiating with people and talking to people. And one of the salesmen's associations in response to that came back and said, you can't apply time and motion study to our work because so much of it is about personality. And what we do as salesmen, in a sense, are born and not made. And we have to spend a lot of time talking to people because that's important. So they certainly thought personality mattered. They're an odd group also because they're out of the view of their employers a lot of the time. They're travelling somewhere else. They're not easy to spot. And lastly, I suppose, they feature very commonly in popular culture, as Andrew and I argued in a couple of articles. They become, in some ways, a symbol, a metaphor for consumption, for modernisation. From Charlotte Bronte through to George Orwell in the 1930s, people are writing about them and saying, they look like this, they behave in this way, you can recognise them very distinctively. And there's a kind of debate in the literature between two extremes. Are they fundamentally devious, untrustworthy, womanising, likely to trick you and then depart, and you can't trust them, and you can recognise that you can't trust them by the way they dress. They're flashy, they're showy, you can recognise by their manners, you can recognise by their behaviour, particularly towards women, and you can recognise them to some extent by the fact that they don't quite fit any class. They're slightly an uncertain group. And then at the other extreme, there's a model which says, it's a tough job, you have to be hardworking, dedicated, you have to know your product, you have to know what you're doing, and you have to empathise with all these customers. So if each of you is a customer and I'm the salesman, I have to be able to engage with you, convince you that this routine transaction, I'm actually interested in you and your business, and I'm somebody you can trust. Because actually I want to come back in 3 weeks' time and sell you something else. And there's a debate in the business history literature about employers want that restrained, modern, what Strasser calls the salesman with a smile that sells personality, and how do they get salesmen to behave like that. And there's a search for the point in the US or Britain at which salesmen adopt that persona, and it's usually put somewhere between the 1880s and the 1920s, and it's usually seen as employers convince salesmen to behave that way by training them. I actually think if you look at the evidence, those two poles always exist. There isn't a cut-off point where that happens. There's just a tension in selling between those two personalities. What do travelling salesmen do? They're called various things. Bagmen, commercial travellers, later on sales reps. They're a link between the wholesaler and the manufacturer. So some of them work for McVitie's, Cadbury's, Rowntree. Some of them work for wholesalers who represent a lot of companies. And they sell either to the retailer, the shopkeeper, or they sell to a business that is going to use that product as part of manufacturing something. They want to seek orders from people. They display goods. So they sometimes carry a lot of samples around with them. And at least in the early days, they collect money and remit those payments back to headquarters. In various ways. It's an expanding occupation from the 1840s to the 1930s in terms of numbers. So it's a growing occupation, grows faster, as Roy Church has pointed out, than most other white-collar occupations between about 1880 and 1910. As a job, in some ways it has a routine. Generally what salesmen do is they travel a route. They travel the same route repeatedly through the year. They essentially meet the same people, they try and sell them things, they try and extract money out of them, and they provide information back to headquarters on who these people are. So Hosgood and others in their work have provided a lot of information on travelling salesmen who write back to headquarters. Retailer X looks to be on hard times, retailer Y is drinking too much. It is said locally that retailer A is completely untrustworthy, so they're a source of information. They're to some extent a source of information on what other companies are selling, and they're certainly a source of information on what retailers think about the products. They change transport, so they initially travel on foot, then by horse, then by carriage or gig in some way, later on by train, eventually by motor car, sometimes by some combination of all these things. Given their status, particularly by the time they get horses, gigs, rail travel and transport, then for their class, they're more mobile, travelling on higher quality forms of transport than the average person. They carry samples and baggage with them, sometimes just sample books, sometimes physical product. So the classics, I couldn't find a picture, but the classic image of them arriving at a railway station is they arrive with a bag, but possibly trunks or suitcases or other things, depending on what they're selling. What defines them as a group? Well, as far as you can tell, and this is mainly from their trade from their associations and from the trade press, they tend to say they value autonomy and freedom, and they usually most consistently compare themselves to office workers or clerks. So their self-image tends to be, we're the inheritors of the spirit of Raleigh, we're entrepreneurs, we're out on the road selling things, and we're much more dynamic than routine clerks, and we understand business much more than sales managers or anybody else. There's a hierarchy amongst them, which is based really on who they represent. So the better the firm, the higher the status, to some extent on seniority, and usually on distancing themselves from other people. And the people they're most inclined to distance themselves from is door-to-door salesmen. The other group they like to distance themselves from is are criminals. Door-to-door salesmen are seen as the lowest of the low. You know, they're knocking on people's doors trying to sell them vacuum cleaners or encyclopedias or whatever. Little better than peddlers, not very well paid. It's the place you don't want to end up if your career's on the slide. These people would see themselves much more as men of business, and they like to use phrases about themselves like knights of the road, ambassadors of commerce. Occasionally in their paranoid moments, they also would see themselves as being crushed in a sense, as classic middlemen, crushed between the employers and the customers, especially when times are hard. They also would often see themselves as being people that their employers, particularly the people running the firm, should feel loyal to. They see themselves as sometimes describe themselves as confidential men or important men. They want to see themselves on a par with senior clerks. And some of them do rise to be sales managers and sales directors and even to run companies. Alan Lane of Penguin, I think, starts off as a sales rep and eventually runs a company. The other thing which is consistent from 1810s, 1820s through to the 1930s, probably to today, is nostalgia. The previous generation always had it easier, they were always better paid, they were always better dressed. Today's generation is always more hectic, more time pressure. The need to travel by rail is more intense. The need to drive in the motor car, you know, you're meant to cover more people more quickly. Doesn't matter which period you look at, that's always what's said. Sometimes because the sources I'm using are people's reminiscences, but even contemporaries writing in trade journals tend to say them, which in a sense makes it hard to gauge what the reality is because the nostalgia is always very strong. This is one image of a commercial traveller. Put it up as a nice image. He's driving a gig somewhere in the 1840s, 1850s, I guess. Partly with him, he doesn't look flamboyant or anything else. It just looks like hard work, and he's dressed, I guess, for protection against the weather. But I'll come back to him in a minute. The other features of them is they're always mobile. Town travellers might only travel around one town or city. Country travellers would go long treks, so a country traveller might be away in the 1850s or 1860s for 3 or 4 months, travelling a route. Might just do 2 to 3 journeys a year, 3 to 4 months for a couple of journeys. They tend to be men. They tend to go on the road from somewhere in their mid-20s. Often they've been clerks, which may account for why they think clerks are terrible. They've moved out of that. Sometimes they've moved out of the warehouse onto the road. They can travel certainly for anywhere up to 60 years. You get these people retiring in the 1930s after 60, 70 years on the road. Sometimes what that means is their son's taken up the business and they're doing little bits at the end rather than they're very active. There are women travellers, they're always there in the census. Their numbers are increasing in the 1920s, 1930s. Compared to the men, they're younger, much less likely to be married because they would give the job up on marriage more commonly. Much less information about them. One or two wives who take on their husband's roots during the First World War, for example. Odd suggestions at times that women are working as commercial travellers or called commercial travellers in some of the clothing trades where they would deal more easily with women. Some suggestions that there are some items where women are more suited. Probably not till the 1940s and 1950s that women are becoming prominent in the trade associations. And I'll come back to that, but their prominence is usually the male trade association wanting to keep them out. They have a very distinctive associational life. There are lots of associations. They meet each other travelling on the road. They tend to stay in commercial hotels or commercial inns. Usually the commercial hotel has a commercial room where they can meet, and they would dine separately from the rest of the clientele. The commercial room would be big. It would have writing desks so they could write reports and they could post things. It would have places to store all their luggage. And there's a hierarchy of having a commercial dinner. The most senior commercial traveller would host the dinner. Everybody else would be a fairly formal etiquette to it. The associations have local branches which run right the way through to the present. One or two trades, confectionery and tobacco, have their own specialist associations. So they're quite a distinctive group in that sense, and they see themselves as part of that group. Though I think the chances are that the most reputable people are the people that are part of that association. And it's the associations that I have to rely on often for these defences of their situation and these critiques of how they're treated. They have a reputation for dressing in a showy style and for bad manners, and to some extent I think they're part of managing an identity in a kind of uncertain profession over a long period of time. I've increasingly begun to wonder if they're also part of something I less and less think I understand, which is masculinity, that how do they negotiate that process? Compared to the first guy I showed you, this is the more flashy commercial traveller. Somewhere in the 1820s, driving along in his gig, he has his horse, can't quite see it, but he has a dog sitting next to him. He's fashionably dressed. These at the top are all his possessions, boots and clothes and everything else. And he's driving at a furious pace. Even at this point in the 1820s, this character is part of a story, the commercial tourist or gentleman traveller, which is a story about the evils of this man and how badly he behaves when he's on the road. So even from the 1820s, this disreputable traveller is in evidence. Drinking heavily, being rude to people, cheating his employer. Eventually, symbolically at the end, the employer turns up, seizes his horse and gig and forces him to walk home. It's harder, I think, to track down beyond those sort of images what the commercial traveller actually looked like, so I was going to run through fairly quickly some images of them. The 19th century accounts that describe them talk about them. Here's a description of a commercial traveller in 1875 who was missing, so they provide a fairly detailed description of what he looks like. A high hat, a black frock coat, black necktie, large gilt links in the shirt. This flamboyance of jewellery or gilt was often associated with them. Very consistent theme, and it's used a lot in novels to describe them. They're always wearing some kind of jewellery or something that is more flamboyant. Wills, travellers in around 1900, certainly frock coats and silk hats. They were seen, according to the main business historian of the company, as an elite group. At that point, they were earning £400 to £800 a year, some of them. They were very stylishly and fashionably dressed, and they were taken, as far as you can tell from the business history, very seriously by the company. This man is a drapery traveller, a man called Henry Search. Put him in because it's a description, but also it shows a bit of change over time. So he claims to have been dressed in knee breeches, low shoes, buckles and white stockings when he first started travelling in the 1840s, which was flamboyant in a way. I'm not sure the white stockings were very practical. Later on, moves to a blue dress coat with gold buttons and a white frill shirt. Very ornate, very stylish. When he dies in the 1890s, the comments on this were to say, well, he was viewed as an oddity because this stood out from everybody else. So maybe he's a kind of curious character. But he certainly works consistently over about a 45-year period. Interwar, all of the commentary, and now this falls into the area where the nostalgia may become a problem. The commentary in the interwar period begins to change. So Mr. Bowles, who retires in 1937, says, well, the old commercial travellers, when he started, which was the 1890s, top hat, morning coat, waistcoat slip, yellow gloves, was the style. Bowles claims he was turned away when he first wore a lounge suit at some point, because he was viewed as not respectable enough to be dealt with. George Orwell, in a couple of novels in the 1930s, is still talking about travellers in terms of these yellow gloves and these ornate style. And most of the trade journal accounts, also for the 1920s and 1930s, are beginning to say, well, the old style of dress, which was these frock coats, the high hats, is beginning to disappear, and instead we're getting a much more subdued look in terms of these suits. A number of items in the trade journals begin to say, well, they're not gentlemen of the road anymore by the 1920s and 1930s. And they're contrasting what they call the esteemed salesman of the past. So this figure who would turn up once every 3 months, it would be a great event because he was representing an important house. He would be well-dressed, stylishly dressed. He would be ushered in for conversation and then almost graciously agree to sell something to the retailer. That apparently is being replaced by what the trade journals start talking about. Dozens of men lounging about, smoking cigarettes, reading papers and cracking jokes. And there's a definite feel in the trade journal accounts that there's a decline in standards, certainly a change in dress style towards more subdued colours, more straightforward suits. A couple of things may be at work there. The drapery trade seems, on the basis of adverts for jobs, to hire a lot more people on short-term contracts for the season, pay them almost entirely on commission, and shove out large numbers of them to try and sell things quickly. So the drapery trade may have more of this floating, less secure class between the wars. There's also a rush of people joining commercial travelling in the 1920s. There's a lot of commentary about ex-servicemen no longer able to settle back to mundane life, deciding that life on the road would be more exciting and signing on. So it may be that the class of salesman changes at some point in the early 1920s. The trade depression of the 1930s also undercuts a number of trades. Orwell, when he's writing The Road to Wigan Pier, stays in a boarding house, and he says, well, a Cockney traveller is staying there who used to work for a better class of firm and used to stay in the commercial inns. Now he has to stay in a boarding house. And he was kind of resentful of the conditions and resentful of the food and that kind of thing. So some people may have been on the slide between the wars. I think also in general the companies were trying to sell more intensively in reaction to the depression. They were sending more men out on the road. They were cutting down the regular salaries, paying them much more on commission. And by 1945, you have a column, the Charlie Chatterbox column, which is in a confectionery trade journal, writes a column in this journal every year for 1922, I think it starts, through into the 1940s. And he concludes that travellers used to be gentlemen of the road, but are now becoming touts or tricksters. And there's a lot of lamentation, not just by Charlie Chatterbox, but by a number of other writers who say, you don't stop for the leisurely commercial lunch anymore, you grab a sandwich in a hurry at a cafe, the old styles, ways of working have disappeared. Now again, it's a bit hard to tell whether that's another wave of this nostalgia, whether it's genuinely true. I think probably it is genuinely true. What seems to have happened is that companies are much more inclined to give their salesmen cars and have them work small areas much more intensively than in the past. And what I want to go on to argue is that there's some change, particularly in the confectionery trade, which Charlie Chatterbox may be picking up on, which is actually undermining commercial travellers in some ways. What I'd begun to wonder for the 1940s and 1950s is if a number of different broader changes in society actually undermine the old position of commercial travellers. If you go back to one of my starting points, they're mobile, they're entrepreneurial, they're independent. That's what they valued, that's what they saw themselves as. And I wonder if some of that is undercut in the 40s and 50s. There are some different wartime images of masculinity to do with military service. This is a Macintosh ad, which I just liked because it shows this is the product, and these are people dressed up. When they return to City Street, they'll find Macintoshes. But the image of these, that's being offered of these people in military service, is very different to the image of the commercial traveller. That's a sales representation, it may not reflect reality. But what I wonder is, during the war, the image of the commercial traveller as masculine, active, maybe is replaced by the image of servicemen, the armed forces, fighting. But there's a different set of images. Commercial travellers are called up like anybody else or join up like anybody else. But the surviving commercial travellers tend to be older. And they're less mobile. They're less mobile than servicemen. They're not going overseas. They're not doing dramatic things. They're less mobile within the country because during the war, the shortage of supplies means that sales territories are restricted. You can't sell UK-wide anymore because the government wants to economise on fuel and distribution costs. Salesmen had always been associated with this not being very respectable and with a degree of sexual licence, with the possibility that they were having affairs left, right and centre. Maybe wartime changes in marriage, divorce rates increasing, more evidence of sexual behaviour becoming more open, means that they stand out less possibly than they did in the past. The disreputable image maybe doesn't work as distinctively as previously. And there's some writing by Chibnall on access to pulp fiction, which he explicitly says, well, before World War II, very little pulp fiction or erotic literature around. Commercial travellers were a group who accessed that. By the 1940s, with Penguin putting out cheap paperbacks with military service, Chibnall argues that there's more access to this range of fiction and a range of erotic literature, which again maybe makes commercial travellers less distinctive to men in general during the 1940s. So I'd begun to wonder if one of their defining features, one of their self-perceptions of mobility and a particular sort of womanising, heavy drinking element, somehow they stand out less in the 1940s. Certainly their other self-perception as being crucial to business begins to change. The government, as I say, zones the country. So if you're selling confectionery, I think they split the country, the UK, into four zones. And generally what they say is the south will be served by these companies. And therefore, if you're a company in the north, you basically can't sell anything in the south. Your market is confined to the north. So suddenly these people are not selling more widely. They're not travelling as widely as they were. They're affected by petrol rationing. They're affected by the restrictions of supplies. Most companies cut back on the number of commercial travellers during the war as a result. This is from the Confectionery News. It's a post-war advert when zoning ends. So this is the symbol of Sharp's Toffee. He's constrained here by zoning, which is holding him back. But this is put out in, I think it's 1945, saying we're about to end zoning. So suddenly all of you in the rest of the country who haven't been able to get Sharp's Toffees will be able to get them again. But actually, even when zoning ends, supply shortages particularly mean that confectionery is seen as a luxury good. They don't free up supplies of sugar and supplies of fuel, particularly to help the confectionery industry. So 1946 to 1949, it takes a long while for normal trade to resume. During that period, Macintosh, sales manager, is asked by the board, could he prune back a bit on the number of salesmen? He had about 120 12 salesmen before the war, he's now got 84. And they say, well, do you need 84 salesmen? Because the market is still affected by rationing. And he launches an interesting defence of salesmen, where he says, well, actually they don't sell anymore, we're really just distributing. Because anything we can make, somebody will take it. All we're doing is making a fair distribution. If all of you are shops, we're trying to be reasonably fair to you in what we give you. But what he says is, well, we actually, even though they're not doing their normal job of selling, we have to keep them, because we've got to keep all of these shops happy until the point at which we can resume normal business. And you also get a Dundee firm sends, it's actually a jute firm, it sends sales reps each year down south, and they do a tour. They go all the way from Dundee, they go through Edinburgh, Carlisle, Birmingham, they come Bradford, they come down to almost to London. They sell nothing, as far as I can tell. And all they're doing is saying, remember us from pre-war, we're back. You know, when we've got anything to sell to you, we would like to sell to you. They're catching up on news. So for two or three years, they're just collecting information, they're trying to re-establish contacts. And sometimes they're just coming back and saying, we've lost that business, we'll never get it back, because they're just dealing with some other consumer, some other supplier. So I wonder also in the 1940s and going into the 1950s, if some of their economic rationale isn't being undercut. This is from the Draper's Record, some adverts that this particular wholesaler runs in 1946. 3 points I wanted to draw out of it. It's called Reflections of a Restricted Rep. So it's exactly this time period when they don't have products. They use the cartoon image with the head of an actual rep, Mr. James, imposed on it. And what he's saying, there are about five of these adverts over 5 months. Basically, the bit underneath says, we're short of everything. We don't have chenilles, we don't have damasks, folk weaves are finished. No slabs, reps, chintzes, no brocade. Don't ask for them. They're not being made. There are some similar ones for corsets and undergarments and various other things. So that's, again, this restricted image I thought was quite an interesting one. This is what he actually looks like, and I guess he seems to be typical of what Betts were dressing as. He's got the suit, the tie, pocket handkerchief, reasonably respectable-looking figure. But he's not able to sell. And what I began to wonder when I looked at this was whether the rep's disreputable image and sales function for a period between maybe 1940, 41 and 1953, 54 is replaced by the SPIV, who it seems to me bears a family resemblance to the sales rep. The SPIVs are involved in crime, so at one extreme they're major criminals, very violent criminals, which isn't anything you can assign to a commercial traveller. A black market has grown up in which the SPIV is able to participate, but also retailers, delivery drivers, a range of officials are able to involve in crime. And the general public, to some extent, are buying from the black market. There are some cases of commercial travellers convicted for theft and embezzlement at the same time. But what it seemed to me was the SPIV character is actually providing goods and begins to, or acquires, some of the same characteristics that used to be assigned to commercial travellers. So Hughes, writing about SPIVs, describes two types of SPIV. This top one, silk shirts and 50 guinea suits, these were major criminals, according to him, mainly in and around London. And then lower down, Czech sports coat and flannel trousers. There's some Osbert Lancaster cartoons of a SPIV, soft hat, whip striped suit, burnt cork moustache. And then David Kynaston, in one of his books on the austerity decade, talks about the SPIV, the coat with the wide lapels, the padded out shoulders, the big knot in the tie and the pencil moustache. So these images are around in the late 40s, early 1950s. And these are a couple of them. This is Flash Harry, George Cole in The Bells of St. Trinians in 1954. Probably a bit more working class down market SPIV maybe in the image. This is the Osbert Lancaster cartoon from 1947, the SPIV character is the figure here with the wide shoulders and the hat. And what I, for the first time, you find much less critique of commercial travellers than you had for 100 years or so before, and I wonder if the Spiv character begins to take over. Roothouse, Mark Roothouse in his book, but also Hughes and one or two other people, begin to argue that in the context of rationing and controls in the late 40s, early 50s, the Spiv is viewed with a bit more, appreciation that they're doing a useful service. It's the government's fault that there isn't enough supply of goods. The Spiv is providing products. There's still a critique of the black market in wartime. There's still a critique of the big major criminals. But the man who can provide you what you want, the Spiv seems to get more reluctant admiration or acceptance. And I think maybe the commercial traveller who up and the Spiv is seen as this sharp dresser, womanising character, man on the make, in a way which commercial travellers had been for 150 years beforehand. And I wonder if something about their inability to sell goods is creating a space in popular thinking about consumption where the Spiv can fit in. Commercial travellers are aware of this crisis, and they have a response to it, and I want to finish up by looking a little bit at how they respond. Essentially what I want to argue is that they respond by reoffering this image of them as respectable, important and hard-working. In 1953, the Manufacturing Confectioners Commercial Travellers Association, it's the main body representing confectionery travellers, it concludes that, I think their figure is 50% of commercial travellers had never operated in a peacetime, normal, competitive market. So in 1953, as rationing of sweets is coming to an end, they arrange a convention to advise people on how to deal with the return of competition. And what they advocate is be positive, be knowledgeable, behave in a restrained way. Don't exaggerate about your products or push them. Don't keep your hat on. Don't smoke unless asked. And don't gossip about other people's business, because the person you're gossiping to will assume you'll then go to the next shop and gossip about them. So what they offer is this modern image. Now that image is consistent from about the 1840s. Anybody who says, how does a traveller prove successful, that's the advice they're offered. This is what 1957 looked like. I apologise for the quality of the images. I did it too quickly. These are from the Draper's Record, and this one is from the Confectionery Review. 1950s salesmen, broadly what I would argue is they're almost all men. As far as you can tell from the pictures, they're older, though I'm beginning increasingly to doubt whether I can recognise age reliably from old photographs. Maybe make some assumptions about age which are wrong for the period. They're certainly male. This is an association gathering in London. They're all gathered around the piano. It's the suits, the lounge suits, pocket handkerchiefs, one or two holding pipes, most of them holding beer. Seems to be a sing-song. It's a stag night from one of the London branches of the confectioners. The styles that are described in the 1950s are fairly consistently lounge suit, pocket handkerchief, tie, long coat and hat. Occasionally a nod to the practicalities of travel. The group I know least about, need to find out more about, are travellers overseas. Because at this point, when you couldn't sell at home, the government is pushing you to sell abroad. The export drive is a big thing. The only person I've found talking about this so far is a man called Oscar Phillips, and he advises overseas travellers wear brown suits. Have two or three brown suits, and either white or brown shirts for ease of use, and an overcoat, and then he lists a whole range of things like typewriters and spare pencils and a torch, I think you take. The lounge suit becomes ubiquitous. They're still pretty firmly, as I can see, middle class. If they have any formal events and dinners, that's almost always black tie, ball gowns for the ladies, very formal. There's still also, I think, in some of the formal events of the associations, a Masonic element. The president of the association always looks like a local mayor or a mason or something, because there's always a chain of office and that kind of thing. The disreputable traveller does survive, though. What from the 1840s was sometimes called the drummer, this womanizing, disreputable figure survives. This is a cartoon from Confectionery News. There were about 8 or 9 of these lolly and pop cartoons about pop and lolly running a shop. The reps only come in a couple of times. I picked this one because this is, again, smart suit, but he's looking quite stylish here. He looks quite affluent to me. Hat, pocket handkerchief, tie, fairly youthful image. Fits with the drummer thing in the sense that he comes in, the woman is, Lolly is attempting to persuade him to give them more supplies than normal. He talks to Lolly for some extended period of time, then walks out essentially saying, well, I'll just send you what I normally send you. So he's not falling for the trick. It's unusual. Lolly in most of these cartoons is seen as duping other people and occasionally duping commercial travellers. So that style, that image is still there, that womanising element is there. It's there sometimes also in their speeches at dinners. They always like to say we're respectable, but we have a way with the ladies, or there's something of an edge to them. So they don't like entirely to pursue this line of respectability. And there's some very odd images, which I couldn't get good copies of, occasionally of men at these dinners, very formally dressed in suits, and then trying on women's clothes or wearing undergarments in very odd ways. And there's something, again, I'm not sure I understand about masculinity, wartime experience, quite what's going on with there. There's some people who look very formal. So just when you convinced yourself from all the pictures that these are associations run by old men who look very formal and very rigid and they're very respectable, you get these odd moments where there's something else happening day to day, and the minutes of their meetings are frustrating because they just record the dull stuff. The dull stuff, though, perhaps is also reflected in some of these other images, people selling them products. This is a display case, companies selling the display case. Again, the image here is very formal, very subdued. And I think over time, compared to the top hat, frock coat, yellow gloves, they are moving towards these more subdued, more formal styles. But it may be that the pocket handkerchief element, the stylish hat, you know, some of that is still this appeal to something that's a bit more exotic, a bit more upmarket. A survey in 1960 talks about older choices, the bowler hat and the formal suit, or the rumpled lounge suit beginning to disappear. So again, this is an improving journal. They want to tell salesmen how to do better, and they're tending to say, well, you need to own 5 suits, spend some money on them, own 10 shirts. Not time this as well as I should, but what I think does begin to happen in the mid to late 50s, though, is that the trade begins to split between the upmarket people who are still stylish but probably are now beginning to dress more like their employers would like, and the floating clientele at the bottom. And I think there's a bigger change in marketing going on here. By the mid-50s, you've got commercial television, so you can advertise goods on television. In the mid-50s through to the early 1960s, resale price maintenance is ending. Resale price maintenance, such as fixed prices for goods sold everywhere. As that ends, you can begin to sell goods more cheaply in large stores and less cheaply in small stores. It begins to undermine the small confectioners, the small shops. And there's a range of mergers and acquisitions. And some of the companies begin to sell directly from head office to large accounts rather than relying on salesmen. And I think these forces of change happen particularly in confectionery. Confectionery, the wartime restrictions on sweet supplies end in 1953. Sales actually peak in 1954 and then level off. The big 5 confectionery companies had generally fixed prices and trading conditions, but that begins to weaken in the 1950s. And there's a number of mergers, a number of small confectionery and toffee producers begin to disappear, many of the independent wholesalers begin to disappear. And I think one of the laments in the trade press about this is commercial travellers who worked for these small firms are being squeezed. Their companies are disappearing. The successful reps in the 50s are working for the major brands, Cadbury's, Roundtree, Mars. there's a range of people who advertise, who advocate modern marketing, sales managers, the trade press. Tom Sumner from Mars talks about, let's call these people commercial travellers. Stop calling them commercial travellers because that makes them the butt for music hall comedians, to call them sales reps. That modernisation is still a bit cautious. There's a tendency to say we can use American methods, but Britain's a bit different, so we can't copy them exactly. And the people like Sumner and the commercial travellers, I think, settle on an agreement that personality and individuality matters. So they tend to say, we can give you advice, we can script what you should say, but ultimately salesmen have something to offer through their personality. So I think what happens in the late 1950s is the salesmen begin to see that the advertising on TV helps them, the support from the companies helps them, the small firms who aren't doing those things disappear, their commercial travellers are under pressure, and there's a blend of agreement around shaping a form of personality. So I think Mills ultimately is right. There is this shaping of personality. I think it's a bit more negotiated between the salesman and the firm, rather than a wholehearted change or adoption. And I think some of it, to me, I'm beginning to wonder if it involves this crisis in the 1940s, early 1950s, and this change of conditions. The 150 years of stability had been because there were a lot of small firms, a lot of manufacturers. Those conditions, I wonder if they're broken in the 1940s and early 50s. This agreement around the importance of personality is reflected by a sales director for Bassett's in 1956 saying, we're looking for a decent chap with a pleasant personality. Not much science or modernisation in that. And the Confectioners Travellers Association puts in a PR officer in 1961, which is a sign, I guess, of how much under pressure it feels. He says, well, some salesmen may be smooth-tongued and over-hearty, but most are friends and advisors to retailers, and he's trying to be reassuring that they're not just taking orders, that there's something they can offer. So they're still negotiating over what their role is. And in 1962, one of the trade journals says, well, there are two sorts of confectionery reps. The young man with the curly brim trilby, the immaculate suit and the company tie. This is the person working for Cadbury or Roundtree, the big companies. And then the other person is this casually dressed hat, if worn on back of head, comes in breezily, talks about fishing and football, makes a few wisecracks, especially if he's selling to a woman. That's the classic respectable and not very respectable commercial traveller of the 1840s. They end up concluding, well, either of these approaches can work depending who you're selling to. But I think the push in the 1950s and early 60s is towards this first category. I'll skip on something in the interest of time. What do the commercial travellers do at an associational level in response to this? This Commercial Travellers Association is a good one. They have about 1,500 members. It's still small, only about 10% of all the travellers. There's still some elements of this disrespectable image that they share, though most of their social activities are classically middle class. They have conferences, they play golf, they have whist drives, they have formal dinners. They have cars more than most people, so they have treasure hunts and car events periodically. They're always anxious over pay and their status. They're always obsessed that they're being changed into mere order takers and they're losing their entrepreneurial independence and individuality. Through the late 50s, they start to think we should have a minimum wage or we should have a more guaranteed income, but they always hold back from ever thinking that there should be a trade union. There is one union-oriented commercial travellers organisation, but it's very small, pretty weak. What they always say is, essentially, we've got more in common with the employer than we have with workers, and if we were unionised, the employers would treat us even worse. And there's a divide, I think. Those with cars, with expenses and with major firms, I think are doing very well. They're securely middle class. They're a bit nervous. They're selling tobacco. They're beginning to get a bit nervous about these reports about the health effects of smoking. Dental effects of eating sweets are a bit of a worry. But mostly they see themselves as allying with the employer to convince people that these are not major issues. So they're still a long way away from where they end up in the 1970s as joining ASTEMs and becoming a white-collar union. They're still much more entrepreneurial. They generally resist women joining. There are some women members, one or two, but generally they're still opposed to that, although they begin to debate whether they should allow it. And they're very resistant when one or two companies start to run schemes where they tell the wives of commercial travellers about bonuses that their husbands can earn from selling more. And the PR officer for the Commercial Travellers Union explicitly writes to the confectioners at that point saying, you're interfering in the normal relationship between a man and wife. You shouldn't be telling wives anything about their husband's pay or the possibility that they could earn more by working harder. What the traveller needs from a home life is to go home and have some peace and quiet, not to go home and be told, if only you were selling more, we could earn more. So they're not buying the corporate image entirely either. So apologise for running on longer than I should have done. Conclusions I suppose I would pull out is there's a constant battle between the respectable and the unrespectable. Over time, they travel less, stay away from home less, probably are less distinctive in that sense in their mobility. I think there may be a loss of status in the 40s and 50s, which I hadn't thought of before. And there is this codification of sales work, but I think it's a long, slow, negotiated process. Thanks very much for your time. Negotiated process.